During our last reading of Proudhon on August 28, 2016, we decided to take a side road, veering off his point about the origins of moral evil, his term, which I'm arguing is coterminous with class. Origins of moral evil in the human capacity for reflection, he is arguing. So we veered off in order to put that question in historical context and consider Karl Popper's argument about the origins of quote-unquote Western civilization in the struggle, epitomized in his example, by the conflict between Athens and Sparta in the 5th century BC. The origins of Western civilization in the struggle to realize our human longing for the open society, what we call freedom here. In this space, that time now is within reach when only love rules over us. We'll be asking whether the, and that's the open society we are arguing, when there is no force sitting on top of us. We'll be asking whether the additional insight that Proudhon brings to the matter allows us to come to consensus with Popper by reconceptualizing the notion of the striving for civilization as the striving to end class. Quote from Karl Popper, "Perhaps the most powerful cause of the breakdown of the closed society was the development of sea communications and commerce. Close contact with other tribes is liable to undermine the feeling of necessity with which tribal institutions are viewed. And trade, commercial initially, appears to be one of the few forms in which individual initiative and independence can assert itself, even in a society in which tribalism still prevails. These two, seafaring and commerce, became the main characteristics of Athenian imperialism as it developed in the 5th century BC. And indeed, they were recognized as the most dangerous developments by the oligarchs, the members of the privileged or of the formerly privileged classes of Athens. It became clear to them that the trade of Athens, its monetary commercialism, its naval policy, and its democratic tendencies were parts of one single movement, and that it was impossible to defeat democracy without going to the roots of the evil and destroying both the naval policy, and this is, I think we should think here, freedom of movement of the citizens, both destroying both the naval policy and the empire. But the naval policy of Athens was based upon its harbors. Accordingly, we find that for more than a century, the empire, the fleet, the harbor, and the walls were hated by the oligarchic parties of Athens as the symbols of the democracy and as the sources of its strength, which they hoped one day to destroy. Much evidence of this development can be found in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, or rather, of the two great wars of 431 to 421 and 419 to 403 BC. The two great wars between Athenian democracy and the arrested oligarchic tribalism of Sparta. And for reference, Plato lived from 428 to 348 BC. When reading Thucydides, we must never forget that his heart was not with Athens, his native city, although he apparently did not belong to the extreme wing of the Athenian oligarchic clubs who conspired through the war with the enemy. He was certainly a member of the oligarchic party and a friend neither of the Athenian people, the demos, who had exiled him, nor of its imperialist policy. And he says, "I don't intend to belittle Thucydides, the greatest historian, perhaps, who ever lived. But however successful he was in making sure of the facts he records, and however sincere his efforts to be impartial, his comments and moral judgments. His comments and moral judgments represent an interpretation, a point of view, and in this, we need not agree with him. Thucydides writes, quote, certain Athenians were privately making overtures to them, i.e. to the Spartans, in the hope that they would put an end to the democracy and to the building of the long walls. But the other Athenians suspected their design against democracy. Unquote. The loyal, continuing with Popper, the loyal Athenian citizens therefore went out to meet the Spartans, but were defeated. It appears, however, that they had weakened the enemy sufficiently to prevent him from joining forces with the fifth columnists within their own city. Some months later, the long walls were completed, which meant that the democracy could enjoy security as long as it upheld its naval supremacy. This incident throws light on the tenseness of the class situation in Athens, even 26 years before the outbreak of the Peloponnesian War, during which the situation became much worse. It also throws light on the methods employed by the subversive and pro-Spartan oligarchic party. Thucydides, one must note, mentions their treachery only in passing and does not censure them. Nearly the whole Hellenic world, writes Thucydides, was in commotion. In every city, the leaders of the democratic and of the oligarchic parties were trying hard, the one to bring in the Athenians, the others, the Lacedaemonians. The tie of party was stronger than the tie of blood. The leaders on either side used specious names, the one party professing to uphold the constitutional equality of the many, the other, the wisdom of the nobility. In reality, and remember, we are quoting Thucydides here. In reality, they made the public interest their price, professing, of course, their devotion to it. They used any conceivable means for getting the better of one another and committed the most monstrous crimes. And my interjection, I suspect it's by reference to illustrations such as this of the amorality of rule, that the present would-be gods justify their own monstrous crimes. Continuing with Thucydides, this revolution gave birth to every form of wickedness in Hellas. Everywhere prevailed an attitude of perfidious antagonism. There was no word binding enough, no oath terrible enough to reconcile enemies. Each man was strong only in the conviction that nothing was secure. Unquote from Thucydides. Continuing with Popper, the full significance of the attempt of the Athenian oligarchs to accept the help of Sparta and stop the building of the long walls can be gauged when we realize that this treacherous attitude had not changed when Aristotle wrote his Politics more than a century later. We hear there about an oligarchic oath, which, Aristotle says, is, quote, now in vogue. This is how it runs. Quote, I promise to be an enemy of the people and to do my best to give them bad advice, unquote. It's clear that we cannot understand the period without remembering this attitude. Many facts recorded by Thucydides, for instance, the attitude of the democratic and oligarchic party leaders, show that Sparta was popular not among the peoples of Greece, but only among the oligarchs, among the quote-unquote educated. And Thucydides' narrative contains many instances which prove Athens' popularity among the democrats and the suppressed. But who cares for the opinion of the uneducated masses? Spartan methods were dominated by the ultimate aim that dominated its policy, by its attempt to arrest all change and to return to tribalism. This is impossible, says Karl Popper, as I shall contend later on. Innocence, once lost, cannot be regained, and an artificially arrested closed society, or a cultivated tribalism. And here, my comment, we must keep in mind that what he's talking about is the attempt of a self-organized band of rulers, the contemporary iteration of which are the Plato's tribesmen, to artificially impose tribalism, which is what a society of rigid, fixed class divisions is an expression of, i.e., everyone confines their identity to their narrow group, while the Plato's tribesmen, it just so works out, remain forever on top. Everyone plays their position, quote unquote, and is artificially, because we're told from infancy, happy. The society is closed to change, to new ideas, to thought, to growth. Continuing. Innocence, once lost, cannot be regained. And an artificially arrested closed society or a cultivated tribalism cannot equal the genuine article.